This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Con Simos and Mango Parker from the Australian Wine Research Institute. How are you guys?
We're good, Chris. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for having us, Chris.
Maybe I should actually call you Dr. Mango Parker, because you do have a proper PhD.
Thank you very much, Chris. I'm pretty proud of that. I did it part-time over 5 years with three kids to raise at the same time. So very proud that I managed to achieve that milestone.
Yeah, did it the hard way. What we want to talk about today is last week we talked about smoke tanks and we talked about what is it, how you taste it, all that type of thing. But smoke taint is one of those things that seems to be becoming more of an issue in the world. And it seems like, especially over the last 10 or so years, people are starting to understand what's going on. And I really want to tease out, if I'm a winemaker and I've got smoke taint in my wine, is it all over? Do we just give up? Or is there things we can do in the winery, in the vineyard, to help manage it? And when does it occur? You know, is it something that you, as soon as the grapes bud burst, that's the problem? Or is it later on after veraison, those type of things? So let's start off with, when is the problem time zone for smoke taint?
Yeah, well, so in the Adelaide Hills in 2019, we had a fire breakout. It was a pretty intense but short fire. And there was smoke over some of the beautiful vineyards in the Adelaide Hills over about 3 or 4 days. Now, that came at a time which was quite early in the season, unusually early for us, when the grapes were still peppercorn green, very unripe.
So quite small, before veraison.
Well before veraison. I think it was about 6 weeks before veraison. Now, unfortunately, we did see smoke-affected wines, some very smoky wines coming out of that. But it wasn't all bad news, actually. What we saw in that particular fire was that the smoke effect was very localised. So some vineyards were heavily affected, whereas another block, maybe only a couple of hundred metres away, might be completely clean, because it just depends where the smoke moves. And in that particular fire, the smoke was moving very fast, and so it blew around a lot and had that very patchy pattern of exposure.
And does the smoke get into the wine through the grapes? Do the grapes absorb it, or is it the leaves, the roots?
What happens is the grape berries actually take up the volatile phenols. Those are the chemicals that are floating around in the air that make the smoke smell smoky. Mm-hmm. It's not the same thing as the particles that give you the haze that you can see, but often they come together when there's a bad smoke event. But, yeah, the grapes actually take up, it's almost like they breathe in those volatile phenols, so the smell goes right in. You can't wash it off, unfortunately. It's not just sticking on the outside. We did try that in the early days. And then what happens is the grapevine metabolizes those volatile phenols in order to detoxify them for the plant. And so it adds sugars and forms something called glycosides. The leaves can also do that same process, mm-hmm. But we haven't seen much evidence that those glycosides are transferred from the leaves into the berries. So we think that if it happens at all, it's a very small part of the process. It's just coming directly into the berry, becoming glycosylated, and then stays in the berry as the berry ripens. It's still there at harvest, and then it can contribute to problems with the wine.
So if you got a smoke event before or during flowering, it may not necessarily be an issue, whereas after flowering, that's when it starts to become an issue.
Yeah, I don't know if we have seen any evidence that it's a problem before flowering. Mm-hmm.
It's highly unlikely that that would happen, primarily because it's still a cool part of the season.
Yep.
And obviously what happens in a fire event, it's related to whether there's a heat waves during that season, which obviously creates the conditions. Once you have those conditions, that's when you'd have a fire event possibly occurring.
Yeah, okay. So it seems like the worst time for uptake of smoke taint is when those fires are most likely to occur.
Exactly.
Okay. So you mentioned that you tried washing off the smoke taint, hosing it down, or what'd you do? Get out there and scrub the berries with a little toothbrush or something like that?
There was a lot of things tried at the time. And what we did find was that people were using spray units with high pressure sprays going into their vineyard, trying to do it by hand, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of those were quite ineffective. I think at the time they tried things like even using chemicals to dip grapes into chemical solutions. That didn't work either. Primarily what happens is that a grape berry is actually, when you touch a grape berry, it can be quite waxy. Mm. And so it has an affinity to anything that sort of comes in contact will stick. So a lot of these marker compounds that we use, they tend to reside within the inner layers of the skin, and therefore it becomes very, very difficult for them to be removed or to somehow that they escape that.
Oh, okay. So the glycosides, they're not in the pulp and the flesh; they're in the skin. So
no, the volatile phenols are generally located in the skins, but the glycosides can be throughout the berry.
People have tried washing them. Is there anything else you can do in the vineyard? Because a lot of the things I've seen in terms of managing it seems to be in the harvest and getting it into the winery to help manage some of the smoke taint. Is there anything you can do in the vineyard apart from move your vineyard to a less smoky area?
So probably the biggest contribution to, I guess, reducing some of the risk is to hand harvest those grapes. Now, in some regions around the world where they do a lot of hand harvesting, it makes a lot of sense. But in a lot of regions also is that they do a lot of machine harvesting as well. Mm. And what we do find is that when grapes are hand harvested, there's less likely to have a resultant issue in the wine as opposed to if they were machine harvested.
Why?
Because what machine harvesting does, it really beats the grapes. And so you're getting a lot of mechanical extraction from the juice, and you're really breaking down that skin at a very, very early stage. And by the time those grapes are harvested and by the time they get to the winery, it could be half an hour, it could be 4 or 5 hours, or it could even be 12 hours. So in that process, obviously what happens is that a lot of those marker compounds are released into the juice, which therefore it ends up into the resultant wine.
I could see why that's quite good for white wines, but red wines, you normally leave the juice, you crush the grapes and you leave the juice in contact with the skin. So is that hand harvesting really best for white wines, or does it still work for red wines?
Well, it certainly won't work for red wines, but what you can do is that we know, for example, that higher fermentation temperatures will lead to more extraction. Mm-hmm. We know that longer time on skins will lead to more extraction. And so really what you don't want to do is that, let's say you make a 50 or 100-pound bottle of wine and your vineyard is exposed to smoke. The choice that you're going to make is that this year, can I make the same wine as I have in all of my other years? And you will say no, because if you were to, for example, ferment at a colder temperature or only ferment 3 days on skins or as opposed to you would ferment for 12, then you're going to end up with a completely different style, which means that you're not going to get the price that you expect to get, and your customers aren't going to have the quality which they buy year and year. So there are some very, very difficult questions a winemaker needs to face, and saying, what am I going to do with my conditions this year?
It seems like a lot of the things you're talking about is about skin contact. And when you're talking about going for hand harvesting, which is quite handy for white wines, does that mean that I've got an option? If I've got some Shiraz grapes in my vineyard and I'm going, okay, I've got a bad dose of smoke taint coming in, am I going to land up making rosé wines with very little skin contact, or do I just give up and leave grapes on the vine? What styles of wine can you make reasonably safely with red wines with smoke taint?
Chris, now you have come to the heart of the problem with smoke taint, is that if my grapes have been exposed or my vineyard has been exposed to smoke, what do I do? Mm. what we have done as an organisation and our interaction with industry has basically said is that what we want is that we want the organisation to come up with an analytical technique which gives us some support so we can make a decision of whether we harvest those grapes or not. Now, when the first time a producer has dealing with smoke-tainted grapes, they'll say, look, these grapes look fantastic. It's a warm year. I've got great ripeness. There's no disease pressure or anything. Everything looks fantastic. So I'm just going to pick the grapes. And they say, well, how bad can it be? And they make the grapes and all of a sudden they say, okay, then, well, it's sort of looks a little bit different. It's not what it used to be, but I think I can get away with it. And as that wine ages and ages and they put it in bottle and then they sell it, and then all of a sudden 2 or 3 years, you know, once that wine has been in the retail market, then their customers are saying, why aren't they buying that wine anymore? This is the real fundamental problem with smoke. And a lot of producers are saying, it's like, well, in that year we made smoke-tainted wine, we vinified it, we bottled it, and we had a very, very bad experience. And so what they will do now, they will take a completely risk-adverse approach and saying, we're not going to harvest these grapes at all. And it's interesting, you know, we have these conversations with producers around the world. A lot of them, once they have been exposed to smoke for 1 year, then they just lift their hands and saying, we're going to walk away from the situation. We're not going to harvest anything.
But the smoke tank can be quite localized. So is there a way of testing the grapes before they decide to harvest them to determine if this block's okay, but that block's no good?
Yeah, so of course. So a lot of the work that we have done is that we do have analytical techniques now. And with very, very high confidence, we can tell exactly whether those grapes have been exposed to smoke or not. The other complication is with smoke taint is that the same marker compounds which we measure in smoke-affected grapes also exist in grapes which have not been smoke-affected at all. So the same marker compounds exist naturally. And so initially when we started doing the analysis, there was some confusion about, you know, these grapes weren't affected by smoke, but somehow there was a positive result there. And so with some very, very clever work through our research, with our researchers, you know, we came up with a way of actually determining whether grapes have been specifically smoke exposed or not.
Mm. Does that mean that if it's heavily smoke tainted, you would just leave the grapes on the vine? I suppose I'll get back to the question before. Is there a style of wine that I've got some heavily smoked grapes, can I make a style of wine that will be okay? And you did say also that, you know, the wines, when they aged for 2 years or so in bottle, they became really bad. Is it a case that if I make a very easy drinking wine that has supposed to be sold and flogged, you know, like a Beaujolais Nouveau, drink it incredibly quickly, all a million litres of it very, very quickly at the pub on a Friday, can you get away with making a lighter style of wine or something like that and then flush it through very quickly, or do you just give up?
Well, yes, you can, and that's one of the measures that you can think about. But again, it also comes back down to the producer. And so, for example, if they're making full-bodied, let's say, Bordeaux-style reds or Napa Valley reds, and in the smoke-tainted year, they're going to make everything, you know, rosé-style, I mean, can they sell that?
Yeah.
I mean, that will work. So, you know, what will happen is that because there's less extraction, then you're going to end up with, obviously, a lighter-style wine. You're going to end up with less of those smoke marker compounds. But the other factor is that you have to consider is that if you have a very, very full-bodied wine, its propensity to mask some of those compounds is going to be increased. If you have a very, very light-bodied, a very, very skinny style of wine, then it doesn't have a high propensity of actually hiding those compounds. So it can work both ways, and you need to be very, very careful about what you're doing. With white wines, for example, because they don't spend any time on skins, and things like sparkling wine, for example, you take them off skins very quickly. The pressing cycle is very gentle. And to some extent, you can, I guess, mitigate some of the more sort of extreme levels of potential smoke that you'll end up in your wine. But if you have a lighter bodied wine, as I said earlier, it doesn't have a great propensity to actually hide a lot of those compounds anyway.
Okay. So generally, if you're reasonably heavily affected by smoke taint, is the solution that most winemakers do or viticulturalists, get the right job, vitties. Viticulturists are the unsung heroes of the wine world. All the winemakers get all the glory, but vitties are important. Do you just leave your grapes on the vine? Do you just go, okay, I'll leave it on the vine and I'll come back next year and have another crack at it?
Like I said, I mean, we can't be guiding people on what they should be doing. I mean, we're here to provide the information and they really need to make that decision themselves.
You must know how many people are leaving it on the vines as a rough idea. Is it like everybody leaves it on the vine, 10% carves them? You know, what's going on?
Well, some people can do different things. For example, some people would try to make gin, alcohol, you know, spirit drinks, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
I mean, that can work.
Yep.
So there's a lot of, there was a lot of experimentation done out of the last vintage. And you know, there are some successful examples. What some people choose to do is that they can blend, for example, a very small portion of smoke tainted wine with other wines, which have not been tainted.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore you come up with a blend, but that also is also can be quite risky because we've heard examples where people have tried to do that. And all of a sudden, they end up with a volume two times, three times. That's still smoke tainted.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of risk here. And these are some of the things that we try and do as an organisation. We provide the information, and we do the sensory, and we do those workshops, so that people can make those decisions.
Is there any sort of fining treatment? Or I remember a long time ago, maybe 10, 12 years ago, there was a winery that had some smoke taint. And they used reverse osmosis to strip it out and clean it up. But then apparently the wine went to a supermarket and then the supermarket wasn't happy with the wine a bit further down the track as well. So is there ways of trying to remove some of the smoke taint below threshold levels?
So that's a very interesting question you've asked. So there are quite a few treatments that you can employ to try to remove some of the smoke character, but each and every one of those comes at a risk because it may remove some of those smoke compounds. They also has an action of removing, you know, the gentle, the flavors, the aroma, the tannins, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, there's a compound called carbon, which a lot of you would probably be aware of. Carbon is quite an interesting fining agent, but it has a very, very broad action. So it will remove smoke compound, but it also removes everything else as well. So you can remove smoke compound, but you'll end up with a solution that's water white, for example.
Yeah.
And that's not what you want to drink.
Does carbon remove the bound and unbound glycosides?
It removes everything.
Could you, just hypothetically, making a nice light rosé, run it through a carbon filter, blend in some other stuff to get some flavour back, and then you're happy as Larry, and it's not going to, 5 years down the track, reappear later on?
Yes. Yes, that would be one of the techniques that you can do.
You talk about carbon, but cling film, you know, in New Zealand we call it glad wrap or cling film over in the UK. You can actually fix corked wines with cling film. I don't know if you know that, but if you get a corked wine, you put it into a big bowl, put a big ball of cling film in it, soak it up, and all the cork taint sticks to the cling film. You pull it out and you've got a wine that's drinkable, but it also scalps a lot of other flavours from the wine as well. You're nodding your head, Mango.
Exactly.
Have you done that before, Mango?
Yeah, I've heard of that one.
Yeah, that's a great party trick. That's a great party trick. If you ever want to impress your friends and if you ever have a corked wine, what you do is that you grab, say, a 30-centimetre piece of cling wrap or cling film or glad wrap or whatever you want to call it, put it in a bottle, leave it there for 20 minutes, and after that, taste the wine and you'll find that perhaps a lot of that cork flavour may have been removed. But it also, like you said, the downside is it also scalps a whole lot of other flavours as well.
So that's a bit like that active carbon. And also you're dead right about it being at a party because it's normally the last bottle of wine that you want to drink of the night. Okay, so active carbon or carbon filters, charcoal filters, they seem to be quite a good way of removing it, but obviously you've got the downside of stripping other flavours from the wine. What about that reverse osmosis that I mentioned?
Okay, so we call it nanofiltration. So this is a process where you have selective filtration to remove, what it does, it separates out what we call a permeate. And then you treat that permeate with something like a resin or a carbon, and then you put it back into the wine.
Mm.
That process, what that does is that it removes what we call those volatile compounds because it specifically targets small molecular weight compounds like those volatile phenols. It does not necessarily have any action on those diglucosides.
They're the ones that are bound up with sugar molecules.
Yes. Yeah. So what it will do is that it will remove to some extent those volatile phenols, but it has no action on that level of chemistry where it's going to have an impact on the aging of that wine. So what will happen is that, like you said earlier, is that character, that smoke character, will eventually come back after that wine is aged for a particular period of time.
And how long does it take, aging-wise, for it to come back? Is it like 6 months, 10 years, or a week?
Well, it depends on how much of that pool is actually in that wine. If it's a low level, then it'll probably take longer. If that pool is larger, then it will come back relatively quickly. But it could be within 3 months, 6 months. Sometimes it could be 2 or 3 years.
What about fining treatments, isinglass or anything like that you can run through that'll strip it out?
We have tried a lot of those. A lot of those will not work. The only compound which will be successful is carbon. But as we talked about earlier, it's quite unselective and it will remove everything else as well. Ultimately, Chris, is that there's a lot of compounds, a lot of treatments which will help. But a lot of the treatments also, it will compromise the quality of your finished wine. And if you're a premium producer in anywhere in the world, then the chances are you're not going to, despite all of the extra costs or all the extra effort and all the extra labour that you're trying to recover from dealing with smoke-tainted grapes, you're not going to see a return on your investment or on the quality. And this is a key point about smoke.
What sort of percentage do you think is lost to smoke taint in a typical year in Australia?
There's no such thing as a typical year, so every fire event is different. No, I'm not trying to be evasive here, but...
No.
Every fire event is different and has different conditions. It occurs in different parts of the growing season. It's really a case-by-case basis. Now, you know, when we talked about the vintage in Australia in 2020, and you could talk about the same in what happened in California this year, and you can talk about, well, there was a certain number of tons which weren't harvested. The other factor you also have to consider is that usually fire events occur in dry years, in dry, warm years. Mm. And therefore, as you would understand, if there's no water availability or limited water availability, that's going to have a big impact on your yields and your crop. And so that, in fact, has a far greater impact in terms of yield losses or not recovering your grapes than the actual issue of smoke-tainted grapes not being harvested.
Just for a point of reference there, I guess people around the world were probably watching all the news about the fires in Australia in 2020 mm-hmm. and perhaps thought that the entire continent was on fire. But Wine Australia have estimated that something like 3% or less of our total production was affected by the fires and the smoke in some form. And that's including grapes that were just downgraded in quality, as well as ones that were rejected and outright lost from wine production. So it's actually quite a small percentage, even in such a bad year for us for fires.
The problem is it's quite localized, so certain wineries will be hammered. I can imagine it can be financially very difficult if you've lost a season's growth, especially if you've got some gearing on your debt levels and things like that.
Absolutely. And if people want to help, some wineries have come out and said that they're impacted by the fires. And in fact, they were really well supported by consumers who wanted to buy their products and just keep their businesses going and help out like that.
I'm pretty much finished, I think. But is there something I've missed?
Yeah, I just wanted to reiterate really that it's a global challenge and that our winemakers want to be prepared. They want to know what to do if there's a smoke event. Now we can test the grapes, we can test the wine, and they're getting more knowledge all the time about what options they can try and what's just a lost cause. So I think all the winemakers around the world are getting to that point where they realise it's just something that we need to live with, to be aware of it and to be able to still produce some smart wines with some of those options that Con spoke about.
One just last little thing is it's actually different but related to smoke taint, and that is if you ever go to Coonawarra and drink a Cab Sav, you get that minty eucalyptus. And I understand that smoke taint and that eucalyptus are almost very similar processes in terms of how they get in the final wine, with the oils and the eucalyptus getting on the skins and then being absorbed and then being released as well. Is that your understanding of how that works?
That's a little bit different. I wouldn't try to compare the two. So, for example, you could have a row of basil or rosemary in your vineyard.
Yeah.
And, you know, that potentially could also impart a similar character in your grapes. And eucalyptus is a bit like that, because what you need is that you need to have leaves, for example, from a gum tree that actually fall in the vineyard. Sometimes they can fall into a bunch or a cluster. And as it grows around it, the leaf will be caught there. And once it's harvested, because generally what they do in Kununurra, it's machine harvested as well, not in all places, but it's a common process. And then once it gets into fermentation, and if those leaves are present, so you can remove those leaves and you can manage it like that. Or conversely, what you can do is that the eucalyptus has a spatial effect. So the closer they are to the gum trees, the higher chance that you're going to end up with a eucalyptus character. Some people find that positive. Other people find that, you know, not so positive. But
I like.
We consider that as a regionality character.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, it's a little bit different chemically. Cineol, just from its chemical nature, it can't form those glycosides. So you don't get that accumulation of the precursors in the grapes like you do with smoke taint.
Oh, okay. So 10 years down the track, your Kununurra Cab Sav is not going to get more and more eucalyptus as it comes out.
No.
That flavour will persist over time, and it's delicious. I think.
Yeah, I like it as well. What I like about it is you taste a Kununurra Cab Sav and it's like, bang, I know exactly where that came from. Australia has quite a number of quite unique styles of wine that aren't made anywhere in the world, whether it be Hunter Valley Semillon, Kununurra Cab Sav. There's a number of different styles that have got unique fingerprints that all over them, which is good. Okay, I think we'll wrap it up there, guys. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks very much for having us, Chris.
Cool.